I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, for Monday, March 2nd, the latest on the coronavirus as it continues to spread.
The coronavirus is indeed spreading, and it's starting to spread within the United States. We have contained it so far, but it's clear that it's escaping that containment.
Also on the show, hear about the upcoming election in Israel.
If Netanyahu is the loser of this, he's in real trouble because he faces trial. If he wins, there will be an immediate constitutional crisis.
Plus, meet Kelly Reichert. She directed and co-wrote First Cow. The film is set on the Oregon Trail during the 1820s, and it's about a Chinese immigrant and a cook who become business partners.
There's not an established currency yet. There's all kinds of trade going on, but there is already a hierarchy based on race and wealth.
We'll also hear your census questions, but first, coronavirus. The coronavirus keeps spreading. The first two U.S. deaths from COVID-19 were confirmed over the weekend in Washington State. The virus has made its way to the East Coast now. New York City has confirmed its first case. The spread of the virus to cities, towns, and communities across the USA is inevitable. And that's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But President Trump is downplaying the risks. He has incorrectly compared coronavirus to the seasonal flu.
There's no reason to be panicked about. But when I mentioned the flu, I said, actually, I asked the various doctors, I said, is this just like flu? Because people die from the flu. And this is very unusual. And it is a little bit different, but in some ways it's easier, and in some ways it's a little bit tougher. But we have it so well under control. I mean, we really have done a very good job.
This kind of misinformation is dangerous. Experts warn it could confuse you, your neighbors, your coworkers, and the people you love. And that puts all of us at risk. So we want you to know not just how to protect yourself from the virus, but also how to protect yourself and your family from misinformation. First, let's get to the medical risks. Dr. Bill Schaffner is a professor of infectious diseases and preventative medicine at Vanderbilt University. Bill, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you, Duarte.
So what's the latest on the coronavirus?
Well, as you said, the coronavirus is indeed spreading, and it's starting to spread within the United States. We have contained it so far, but it's clear that it's escaping that containment and is popping up here and there. You know, part of our difficulty is that we haven't been able to test for the virus quite as extensively as we would like. As the test becomes more available, we in infectious diseases are going to be testing many more patients, and I expect we'll be finding more people positive here and there across the country.
We're now seeing cases in the U.S. that health experts describe as, quote, community spread. What does that term mean, and how does it change the situation?
Well, what community spread means is that we can't trace that individual case back to an importation from China or some other country. It means that the virus has gone from an importation to another person and maybe another person and yet another, and now that's the patient we have identified. So that it means the virus is circulating among us, hiding among all those other influenza cases, but we haven't been able to detect it.
When it comes to this virus, what are we seeing in other parts of the world that we're likely to see here in the USA?
Well, other parts of the world that have had imported virus have seen it spread in their countries, creating demand for medical services. And as a consequence, also, these countries, cities, and wherever the virus is, are using social distancing to try to prevent the spread of the virus. And what we mean is, don't go to crowded events where you are face-to-face with other people for prolonged periods of time, because that's how the virus gets from one person to another efficiently.
So we're likely to see more quarantines in the USA. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, I'm not so sure about how much people will be quarantined. There will be some of that, of course. But I think there will be recommendations that we avoid congregate gatherings. Why don't we not go to the movies but watch some television? Don't go wandering around shopping at the mall. Observe your religious services and be reverent at home rather than going to our church or our temple, etc.
So how do we best prepare for a potential outbreak in the USA?
I think it's prudent for all of us, from the business point of view and also from the personal family point of view, to sit down and have a conversation. What's our plan C, the coronavirus plan? How can we function without coming to work or staying at home a lot? What is it that we would have to do? Not go to religious services personally. Make sure that Uncle Tom, who needs his medicines, has a 2 to 3 week supply. On the business side, how many of us can work from home so we don't have to commute and get in face to face? Trying to think through those kinds of decisions in advance.
Thank you so much. Dr. Bill Schaffner is professor of infectious disease and preventative medicine at Vanderbilt University. Thanks, Bill.
My pleasure.
And Yasmin Abutaleb is also here with us. She's a health policy reporter at The Washington Post. She's going to help you and me better understand how the Trump administration is handling this historic moment when a virus is threatening not only your health, but also the national economy. Great to have you, Yasmin.
Thanks for having me.
So you've done a lot of reporting on the coronavirus. How is the administration responding to this public health crisis?
I think we saw kind of a confusing week where the administration was trying to gain better control of the response. Before this week, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar was running a coronavirus task force. And then this week you saw President Trump put Vice President Pence in charge of that. But then the vice president appointed a woman named Debbie Birx from the State Department, who is a doctor who's run a lot of the HIV and AIDS global response. So that was widely heralded. But now you have this sort of confusing structure where you've got three people who all seem to be in charge of the response. And so that's been very confusing.
Has the White House released any, quote, misinformation about the coronavirus?
I think on Wednesday, on Tuesday, you saw a series of very confusing statements from various officials. So you saw a top official at the CDC say, we're asking the American public to prepare for the expectation that this might be bad. And then shortly after that, you saw Trump's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, go out there on TV and say, this is mostly contained. And then when President Trump went and spoke the next day, he said, you know, maybe we'll see one or two more cases. And then later in the week said it will miraculously disappear, which is contradictory to what his public health officials have been saying.
But each of those voices had a different sort of goal. One was the economic advisor. One was dealing with the health situation. Do you think the perspectives from which they come are influencing the messaging?
I think that's absolutely true. We know from our reporting that President Trump and some of his closest advisors are very worried about the economic fallout that's come from this outbreak. You know, global markets have tanked. U.S. markets have plummeted over the last couple of weeks. Last week, they had their worst week since 2008. So there is a lot of concern that there is going to be a long-term economic downturn as a result of this, and that could be a threat to the president's reelection.
So what other consequences of this misinformation could there be?
I think there's a lot of confusion among the public about what they should be preparing for and how bad it's going to get in the U.S. I mean, we do have U.S. public health officials and state health departments reporting as soon as they find confirmed cases. So we saw a number of cases all over the country pop up over the weekend and the first death in the U.S. But there are a lot of conspiracy theories out on the internet right now that this is a hoax or, you know, that it's a, you know, I guess I won't repeat them, but there are a lot of conspiracy theories about the threat of the virus and how it came about. And I think a lot of confusion about just how bad people should expect it to get here.
So what type of plan has the administration put forward to combat the coronavirus?
So we're still sort of waiting to see how it's put out. But a couple of weeks ago, the administration imposed its first federal quarantine authority in more than 50 years. So anyone who was returning from Wuhan, China, the epicenter of the outbreak, had to be put in federal quarantine for 2 weeks, which, you know, early studies showed was about the incubation period for the virus. And then people returning from sort of outbreak centers are put into federal quarantine. What's a bit unclear is how this is going to work as the number of cases grows. You know, does the U.S. And do state and local departments have the capacity to quarantine lots and lots of people? There are people who are put into self-quarantine who are at a little bit lower risk of the virus, who maybe traveled through other parts of mainland China. And that means they're at their homes, but that does also mean they could spread it to family members or people that they're living with.
So there's so much happening right now. You know, on the one hand, if President Trump gets this right and everyone is protected, this could be a huge boost for his reelection. If he gets it wrong, it could be horrible. How is this affecting the way President Trump is thinking about the upcoming election, the coronavirus?
I think what we've seen is that President Trump has very much sought to downplay the risk of the virus over the last week. He has changed his language slightly since the middle of last week. Over the weekend, he said, you know, yes, we might see a couple of more cases, but he is seeking to downplay it much more than his other top health officials are, who have remained fairly realistic since the start that the U.S. was going to see more cases, that it's contained for now, but the number of cases is going to increase. And now that we see greater testing capacity, the thought among infectious disease experts is, you know, this has probably been circulating for several weeks and just was going undetected. So we're probably going to see a big jump in the number of cases as we increase the amount of testing.
So, you know, why did President Trump put Vice President Mike Pence in charge of the outbreak rather than appointing someone with more expertise in managing public health crises? What message was he trying to send by putting Pence at the lead?
I think that's a great question. I know the thought or the fear among some people is that by putting the vice president in charge as opposed to a scientist or a public health professional, that they were seeking to balance sort of the public health aspect and this coordination among agencies that you need, in which you do need someone with authority in the White House, but also that political considerations were going to play a big role in this. So my colleagues and I reported last week that Vice President Pence faces this sort of dual challenge, you know, assuring the American public that he will be fully transparent about the threat of the virus and how it's sort of manifesting itself in the U.S., but then also placating his boss, who is very concerned about the threat this could pose to his reelection and to the impact on the markets. And so we sort of have to wait and see how that's all going to play out. But we do also know that the vice president is routing all communication about the virus through his office now. And, you know, we've seen in past administrations, they have sought to have a sort of central communication control system. So that's not totally abnormal, but we'll have to wait and see just how transparent they're going to be with this new system in place.
And Yasmin, briefly, how can people protect themselves from the kind of misinformation from both the Trump administration and from other sources that could hurt you?
I think the key is to make sure you're listening to scientists and doctors when you're listening to people talk about the threat of the disease. I think you want to make sure you're reading reputable news sources, not sort of picking up conspiracy theories that might be making their way around social media that you know, has sort of an unclear source. And you know, I think that the best thing you can do is to just try to listen to the experts on this, people who have spoken before in infectious disease outbreaks, and to make sure you're looking at reputable, trusted news sites and science outlets and studies and journals, as opposed to picking up theories that are making their way around social media.
Thank you so much. Yasmin Abutaleb is a health policy reporter at Washington Post. Thank you for joining us. And we are committed to continuing reporting on this issue. Tweet us with your thoughts and questions. We're at The Takeaway, and you can reach me at Duarte Geraldino. The nationwide rollout of the 2020 census is just weeks away, and there are some big changes. Some of those changes and procedures may not make a lot of sense to you. Here at The Takeaway, we've been getting questions about everything from how the census is actually done to what it means for certain communities. And to get answers, I want you to meet Terri Ann Lowenthal. Terri Ann's a former staff director at the U.S. House of Representatives Census Oversight Subcommittee. She's also a consultant on census policy and operations. Terri-Ann, so good to have you here.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
So, Terri-Ann, there's still some confusion on some of the basics. Here's a question from one of our listeners.
Hi, this is Susan. I live in Wisconsin, and I just asked, can I do the census online? Thank you.
That's an important question. Thank you. So, yes, you absolutely can answer online for the 2020 census. But here's my top line message. All households will have a chance to self-respond in three ways, online, by telephone, or using a paper form. And if you don't do any of those things, a census taker will visit in person to collect the information.
So if you're doing it online, how do they make sure that the person who is filling it out is actually a real person?
So each household, when it gets its census materials, starting next week, in fact, will be assigned a unique 12-digit ID number for that address. And you can use that when you go online or when you respond by telephone. If you use a paper questionnaire, there's a barcode that ties that form to your household. But I do want everyone to know that if you have somehow misplaced your unique ID, you can still respond without it online or by telephone, and you'll just have to provide your address.
So a few of our listeners also want to understand how the census is funded and what exactly it's used for.
So let's start by making sure everybody remembers from civics class that the U.S. Constitution requires a census. So it is the very first responsibility of the federal government and Congress in particular. Now, the U.S. Census Bureau plans and oversees and implements the census, but it really can't do a good job without the help of partners, what it calls partner organizations at the state and local and even neighborhood level. Now, the federal government pays for the census, but the cost of the census to research, test, and plan and then implement it over 10 years pales in comparison to the amount of federal assistance for very vital services, schools, healthcare, including Medicaid and Medicare, road and transit improvements, housing, food assistance, rural infrastructure improvements, that is guided by census data. And that the numbers we will get from this census, we have to live with those for the next 10 years. Of course, the census is also the very foundation of our democratic system of governance. So I don't think there's any better investment of federal dollars.
It's critically important. So, you know, last week we did a segment on our show about cybersecurity and the census process that kept a lot of people talking, like Emily, who wanted more information.
Hi, this is Emily calling from Williamstown, Vermont. I was wondering how the testing has been going for the new electronic system for the census.
Is it vulnerable to hacking?
You know, I know that is a top-of-mind concern in this day and age for many people. This is the first high-tech census, and I don't think anyone argues with the need to modernize the process, but technology brings cybersecurity risks, both real and perceived by the public. Now, the Census Bureau has been working very closely with all of the cybersecurity experts and agencies in the federal government as well as in the private sector. When you submit your data, however you submit it, it is immediately encrypted when you do, and then the data will be stored in the cloud. So we're hopeful that things will go well in that regard.
We also got some calls from people who were concerned about not being counted, to everything from ranging from sexuality to disability.
Hi, I'm calling from Sunbury, Pennsylvania. My name is Peterson Toscano. My question is, what about gay couples? My husband and I, will we be counted as a couple, legal strangers, roommates? How's it work?
I'm very glad you raised that question. I know it's important to many of my fellow Americans. There will not be a question on this census on sexual orientation and gender identity. There was consideration of that, and unfortunately, it's not happening this time around. However, there is a new opportunity to indicate either same-sex spouse or same-sex partner in what's called the household relationship question. So I think that's certainly a step in the right direction.
Darianne, housing prices all across America are soaring, and we've seen an increase of homelessness. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's less obvious, where people are couch surfing. For people who don't have a stable address, how are you counted?
You put your finger on something very important. So some people who are experiencing homelessness are, as you just pointed out, living in a household on census day. And it's really important for that household to include that person on their household form. Now, for people who are experiencing homelessness, who are not living in a home, a household, there is a special service-based enumeration, it's called, that will go over 3 days and one night at the end of this month. So census takers will visit pre-identified shelters, mobile food vans, soup kitchens, and targeted outdoor locations to collect data directly from people there. And I do urge local service providers and advocates for this population to, in advance, try to reassure people about the safety of being counted and the importance.
Thank you so much for joining us. Darianne Lowenthal, former staff director of the U.S. House of Representatives Census Oversight Subcommittee and a consultant on census policy and operations. Now, you can find all of the census coverage on The Takeaway on takeaway.org/2020census.
Every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Al Jazeera Digital's Duarte Geraldino. This is The Takeaway. For the first time in history, two Jewish American candidates are serious contenders for the U.S. presidential nomination. Heading into Super Tuesday, Bernie Sanders is a front runner, and Michael Bloomberg is still in the race. There's a real possibility that we could see the first Jewish American president of the United States. But Jewish voters don't necessarily appear to be rallying behind Sanders, or for that matter, Bloomberg. In fact, in a recent Pew survey, Jewish voters preferred Biden, Warren, and Buttigieg by a wide margin. Now, Buttigieg has, of course, suspended his campaign. And Sanders, along with Bloomberg, may be alienating some Jewish voters because of their stance on Israel. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is currently holding its annual conference in D.C. More than 18,000 people are expected to attend. Now, to be clear, AIPAC is a pro-Israel advocacy group. Sanders is boycotting the gathering, claiming AIPAC allowed leaders to, quote, express bigotry and oppose basic Palestinian rights. Bloomberg, on the other hand, gave a speech at the conference today. The decision both candidates made about AIPAC is sending a very clear message to voters. Now, here to unpack this, we have two guests. Molly Boygon is here to talk with us about the Jewish American vote. She's an investigative reporter for The Forward. Molly, welcome.
Thank you.
Also here with us is Hasia Diner. She's a professor of American Jewish history at NYU. Hasia, thanks for joining us.
It's a real honor and pleasure to be here with you.
So up until now, what was the closest that a Jewish American candidate has come to becoming the U.S. president?
We can think of it in two contexts. So first, clearly, Joseph Lieberman, who was running for president with Al Gore, stood in line, that is, as vice president. He technically could have become president had something befallen the president-elect, Al Gore. And in a way, it's pretty amazing given that that election hung by a chad, as it were, and that without all sorts of interference. It's actually the case that the Gore-Lieberman ticket really won. so that had the ballot counting in Florida gone differently, or had the Supreme Court weighed in differently, the Gore-Lieberman ticket would have, Gore-Lieberman would have won. And one never knows what could have happened. So Lieberman was really close in that he was there as the vice presidential candidate. The other moment in time where there was somebody of Jewish derivation who was running for president, and I say derivation, was Barry Goldwater in 1964. Yes. Goldwater was not a Jew in as much as he was Episcopalian with a visibly Jewish name and with a clear Jewish ancestry one generation back. But those are the only two we could cite.
The only two. So in the past, have identity politics played a role when Jewish candidates run?
Well, Jews have been running for office in the United States on local and state level since the middle of the 19th century. They often ran and won in places where there were very few Jewish voters, and they presented themselves as good, solid citizens who represented some swath of the community will. Their Jewishness was there. They didn't deny it, nor were these people who were one time or another deeply involved in their local Jewish communities. But they didn't run as Jews. Okay, where there were Jewish voters, they didn't necessarily vote for the Jewish candidate. Jewish voters, again, from data we have going back to, again, the late 19th century, voted on the basis of issues and not on, was this candidate a Jew running against, you know, running for office. There have been individuals way back, more than a century ago, who articulated some level of concern about Jews occupying too visible a role in, shall we say, city affairs, you know, running for mayor. Because if policy went wrong or if matters got out of hand, that individual, their actions would be
reflect on the Jewish community.
Yeah, and that Jews as a whole would be blamed for unpopular decisions.
So, Molly, let's bring you into this conversation. Recent polls are showing much stronger Jewish American support for Biden and Warren. Now, you've been talking to Jewish voters. What are they saying about Bernie Sanders? How is he being perceived in the Jewish communities that you visited?
I hear a few different reasons why Jewish voters are not lining up to support Bernie, and one of them is that anxiety that Hasia was talking about, a fear of a Jewish backlash if he does get elected, or that his Judaism would be a deterrent come time to run against Trump in the general election. I also hear that he hasn't publicly identified as Jewish in the way that a lot of Jews would want. So he has talked a lot about his immigrant background, about being a child living in poverty, but not so much about that strong Jewish connection. And I think that rankles some people. His stance on Israel is also an important part of why a lot of Jews aren't supporting Bernie. They see him as associating with more polarizing figures in the community, like Linda Sarsour and Ilhan Omar. And then lastly, I think I hear older Jews in particular express discomfort with his association with socialism. Like one Jew in the Orthodox community that I was talking to said that his father called Sanders Bolshevik Bernie.
Wow.
So even though you do hear that hesitation from some communities, unsurprisingly, he's also popular with younger Jews, with more liberal Jews. And, you know, Jews tend to vote Democratic, and polls indicate that Jews in this election will vote for the Democratic candidate over Trump in much higher numbers. So we'll see what happens if he gets the nomination.
So if I heard you correctly, you seem to be saying that to some voters, he is not presenting as Jewish enough. What would be Jewish enough?
Well, he hasn't in, you know, I think Bloomberg offers an interesting contrast. Bloomberg going to AIPAC, Bloomberg going to synagogues and presenting himself as a candidate. Bernie's public identification with Judaism has mostly had to do with anti-Semitism and his stances on immigration. Like, he released a couple of videos this campaign cycle about how he believes that Trump is a white nationalist and Trump's platform emboldens white nationalists in this country. And like I said, he has talked about his immigrant background, you know, as a way to identify with voters more than about being Jewish. You know, he, for example, a lot of people don't know that he spoke Yiddish at home as a child. Like, these are just experiences that he doesn't really talk about.
And what about his decision regarding AIPAC? How is that sitting?
I think it was hugely controversial. Obviously, there's, you know, all different sides of this issue, but I would say the loudest Jewish voices in the room were ones that were condemning that decision, because AIPAC is statedly in a bipartisan forum for conversation about Israel and U.S.-Israel relations, and typically support for Israel has been a bipartisan issue, not so much in more more recent history. But I think that people— Jews who view AIPAC as an important gathering for the Jewish community also saw it as a missed opportunity for Sanders to express some of his concerns about Palestinian rights and treatment of Palestinians by the Israeli government.
Has there been historically some issues that have been most important to Jewish voters?
I think if we look again in the long run, Jewish voters have tended to, in terms of the big picture issues, favor candidates who pressed for the creation of and the strengthening of a society in which people are not handicapped at all by race, religion, national origin. That is, a society in which the invidious distinctions, which were baked into American law and baked into the American character, where that was, you know, they're looking for the candidates who wanted to essentially unbake it. Okay. Secondly, Jews have historically been very strong supporters of separation of church and state. Mm. Okay. Of those kinds of policies and the candidates behind them who essentially said, no, this is not a Christian nation. This is a nation of all of its citizens, and all religions or no religion need to be respected.
So, you know, on that note, we look at Sanders' decision, very controversial among some Jewish American voters. Has a candidate that shares Sanders' view on Israel ever won the Jewish American vote?
There has never been a candidate who was anything other than in their public persona and their public statements, anything than 100% supportive of the state of Israel.
So, Molly, what are Bloomberg and Sanders doing to try to appeal to the Jewish American vote, if anything?
I think that Sanders is using his disagreements with Trump and the perception that Trump is emboldening white nationalists to appeal to the Jewish vote now, but that's a very recent change. I think, you know, in the 2016 election, for example, he really didn't talk about being Jewish hardly at all, and now it's used as a way to connect with Jewish voters over anti-Semitism. And Bloomberg is appealing to Jewish voters in a much more traditional way by being crystal clear on his support for Israel and attending AIPAC, and by visiting synagogues and trying to reach voters that way.
It's such a complex catwalk because, on the one hand, obviously they want Jewish American votes, but the majority of U.S. voters are not Jewish. In so doing, what's that friction that they are dealing with?
Yeah, I think that question is especially relevant for Bernie Sanders because in some ways he presents as so Jewish. The way that he talks and the way that he looks, his accent is so emblematic of the sort of Brooklyn leftist Jew of a particular moment, and that negatively impacts him in the way that people express anxiety about electing somebody who's that visibly Jewish and the possible backlash. But then again, his not talking in specific terms about his Jewish background and his Jewish identity, and he's not traditionally observant, he's married to a non-Jew, his stances on Israel, in some ways he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't.
Hasia Diner is a professor of American Jewish history at New York University, and Molly Boygan is an investigative reporter for The Forward. Thank you both for being here.
Great.
Thank you.
We round out our hour today with a new film that brings us back in time. First Cow, directed and co-written by Kelly Reichardt, is set in the Oregon Territory in the 1820s. Now, the film approaches that moment in U.S. history differently than conventional Hollywood Westerns.
What's sort of front and center in most Westerns are a lot of large moments that involve masculine power and revenge. And that masculine power is all kind of goofy in this movie and set in the background. And then we're into these more domestic, small moments with our two protagonists.
The film tells the story of a white cook who travels west with a group of fur trappers. The cook's name is Cookie, and he's played by John Magaro. Now, Cookie is not the typical hyper-masculine character you often see in Westerns. He's much more reserved, and it's not until he meets a Chinese immigrant named King Lu that he's able to form a real connection. The migrant is played by Orion Lee. Kelly's movie is based on the 2004 novel The Half-Life, written by her co-screenwriter John Raymond. The film and the book differ in many ways, but both open with a quote from William Blake. The bird, a nest. The spider, a web. Man, friendship.
You know, it's about friendship and sort of the balance in the natural world. And while it's mostly about this friendship, it does sort of look at this question of capitalism versus the natural world and if those two things can coexist.
Beyond their personal friendship, Cookie and King Lu also become business partners. They steal milk from a wealthy British businessman's cow, yes, a cow, and use it to make donuts. When I sat down with Kelly, she said that beyond telling a gentler story about this time period, she wanted to more accurately reflect the communities living in the West during the early 19th century.
In 1820, in what's now Oregon, you know, yeah, people weren't making the trek across country yet. You know, Cookie did, our main character, and some trappers, but it was very largely people coming by ship from Russia and China. And, you know, and who had been in that area before were the Chinook and the Multnomah tribes had been there for a very long time.
Did you consult with many Native American groups when you were researching this film and how to portray that particular slice of American history?
We did. We sort of worked our way into, there's a beautiful museum in Southern Oregon called the Grand Ronde, and it's a confederation of tribes, and they really have this very intimate, beautiful museum that just opened at the time we started doing our research. And they eventually opened their library to us and connected us with someone that could help us with the language. And April Napier, our costume designer, met through them some women who made the cedar capes that are in the film. And so, and everyone we met had shared their family histories with us and what they had. And then by the end, they were, you know, very sort of keeping us at arm's length at the beginning. And by the end, they, you know, lent us the canoes from out of their museum. So it was really a big thing for us that these new friends we made, to see them show up on location and walk down the mountain carrying this canoe over their head for us. It was pretty great.
Was it a surprise or did you just work it in? I know that you...
We worked it in. Like, John Raymond is always a little bit the diplomat at the beginning of each of our projects. We made a film called Night Moves, and it was a little bit hard breaking in with the communities that were, you know, really living off the land and pretty hardcore environmentalist. And a lot of people, they were sort of suspicious of us as filmmakers in the same way that the people at the Grand Ronde would be, because they've just been misrepresented so many times. And so they were reluctant.
On that note of misrepresentation, what do you do differently that you believe fairly represents them?
You know, first of all, we're dealing with a language that the actors had to learn, which is this jargon, the Chinook Wawa. And I'm editing it, and, you know, it's a difficult language, and I'm hoping we're in the ballpark for, you know. So I don't want to say that we've, like, nailed anything. I mean, really, just putting the camera in a position of an observer of where it's not necessarily the first people being observed, but having their point of, just physically having the point of view of, like, the strangeness is actually the white person in the frame. Just even something like that is maybe a bit different. There's a scene in the movie that takes place in the chief factor's house. And the chief factor is sort of like the CEO that comes to run the beaver trade. And there's a scene with him and his wife, who would be a Chinook woman, played by Lily Gladstone. And Gary Farmer is the kind of prominent man who's representing the local tribes. And there's King Lu, who's the Chinese man in our film. And there's Cookie, who's low on the ranks because he's poor. And so there is this, there's this hierarchy that already exists, you know, and that was a really tricky scene of trying to figure out how to get across and not in the dialogue, you know, through shooting where everybody stood as far as like who has the power in this room and where they are in the pecking order. But yeah, there's already a, you know, there's not an established currency yet. There's all kinds of trade going on, but there is already a hierarchy based on race and wealth.
You've been working in independent cinema for more than two decades now. Has getting financing for your work changed? Is it more difficult now, or is it easier because of your reputation?
It's easier for me now. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we make every film. I feel every time I make a film, it's my last, like, okay, this is really it. No one's going to let us do anything after this.
Why do you feel that way? Wait a minute.
Because I especially felt that way in Meek's Cutoff. Because you're in the desert, you can't really see. We were using these huge bonnets where you could hardly, everyone was supposed to look like this, like a bird almost, and you wouldn't really see the actors' faces. And, you know, you just don't know because telling intimate stories is, it's not like there's a, you know, the climate is very geared towards big and spectacular. But these films, like I have had a very productive decade. And this film, as soon as we, you know, this Scott Rudin's company made the film and they read the script and said yes in like an hour.
In an hour, you got approval.
So yeah, that's never happened before. So it was really fast and almost like took us by surprise, like, oh wow, we're making a film right now.
Are you open to possibly going to the big budget world?
That's not really in my, it's not really a goal for me. There's no one really looking over my shoulder as I'm making these films. It's a very go off and we make them. I've been working with the same producers for a decade and I have a really nice group of people that I work with and we're a really good team and I like the adventure and it's very, you know, it's very livable, and I have a, you know, I teach, and I like teaching.
At Bard College, right?
Yeah, Bard. And so I teach there in the falls, and that's another community that I'm very tied into and keeps me thinking about film in fresh ways that I don't think I would come across somewhere else necessarily. So it's a nice world. It's not, you know, it's maybe not for everybody, but it works for me.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
Kelly Reichardt is the director and co-writer of First Cow. Her film opens in theaters this Friday. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening today. If you ever want to share your insight with us, call and leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.